Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, is it time to own our venues? Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
It's us back together again after our special editions recorded at the Great Escape and Wide Days. We're back to normal this week, though given I wasn't on last week and we took a couple of weeks off before the Great Escape, I'm not sure actually I remember what we're supposed to do. But anyway, I think we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week.
Or we could not do that just for a change, and we could spend the next 40 minutes talking about and celebrating the fact that this podcast is going out on my birthday. So that could be the theme for this edition.
No, I think we should be celebrating that I think I've finally shaken off the COVID I brought back from Brighton.
Yeah, your great escape bout of COVID-19 that you got to enjoy last week, but you're finally over that.
I think so. I can stay awake for like hours at a time.
Was it a special musical kind of COVID, a special seaside brand, or was it just standard boring COVID-19?
Well, it's made the ringing of my ears louder. I guess that you could say that's musical. I don't know.
Your tinnitus.
I'm not in a hurry to get another kind of COVID to check.
But your tinnitus has increased. So that's the music connection.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Anyway, let's not talk about any of those things, because later on, I want to talk to you, Chris Cook, and I guess the listeners, about Sony Music's latest announcement regarding paying royalties to unrecouped artists, which we will do in a bit. But first, the UK's Music Venue Trust last week formally launched a new organisation called Music Venue Properties, which is a charitable community benefit society set up to buy the freeholds of properties that currently house grassroots music venues, providing those venues with the much needed security of having a landlord that shares their interests and objectives.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting project that it's very important, I think, that we talk about on Setlist. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of what this is all about, maybe we should do a little bit of background, a bit of context, although this background context might be me stating the bloody obvious for 3 minutes. Let's see. Because we know all this, but let's remind ourselves that the last 2 years for grassroots venues in the UK and across the world, and indeed for the entire live music sector, has obviously been an incredibly challenging period, unprecedented challenges for everybody in the live sector, including grassroots venues, because of the COVID-19 pandemic and the resulting lockdowns and shutdowns. However, we should also remind ourselves that for grassroots venues, particularly here in the UK, even prior to the pandemic, there were many challenges that those grassroots venues were facing. Things like rising costs, rising rents, rising rates, various licensing issues. And of course, that particularly annoying thing where you have a venue in a part of town that maybe isn't the most desirable part of town. And then because the venue's there and other cultural stuff arrives and cultural businesses arrive, suddenly it becomes a desirable place where people want to live and businesses want to be based. And as a result, because the venue made that part of town cool, rents go up, costs go up, and then sometimes annoying people move in and then complain about the noise and all of those issues. So yeah, there have been lots of challenges for grassroots venues for years now, long before the absolute crisis period that was the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, and dealing with those challenges was a key reason for the Music Venue Trust being launched in the first place. And based on their experience of tackling those issues, the MVT team say that the issue of ownership, by which we mean the fact that 93% of grassroots venues rent rather than own their buildings, underpins almost every other challenge. And it also means that 2/3 of the government support for the grassroots venue sector during the pandemic actually ended up with landlords rather than venue operators. And it's with that in mind that Music Venue Properties has been launched. As I said, a charitable community benefit society, this new organisation will be able to raise money by selling community shares.
Yeah, and that's the process that is now underway. So music fans and fans of vibrant culture in our cities, and indeed investors, probably ethical investors, but all of those people are being encouraged to invest in this new entity. And as MVT explained last week, by purchasing these shares, music fans and ethical investors will help raise funds to allow MVP to buy the freeholds on various buildings that are currently occupied by grassroots venues around the UK, while also receiving a 3% APR return on their investment. And once this new entity has raised the money, and it has acquired the freeholds on various buildings where grassroots venues are based, it will then offer a majority of those grassroots venues an immediate rent reduction, making it easier for them to operate. But moving forward, it will also help to contribute to building repairs and insurance, while also guaranteeing the long-term security and market resistant rents for those businesses. This is how MVT explained this new initiative itself. And 9 venues have been selected for a pilot. So what's currently happening is a fundraising period has been launched. And at the end of that, it's hoped that the funds will be in the bank to then go and acquire the buildings occupied by these 9 venues, 6 of which are in England, 2 of which are in Wales, and 1 is in Scotland.
Yeah, the MVT published a prospectus last week introducing those 9 pilot venues. So they are Le Public Space in Newport, the Palladium in Biddeford, the Hairy Dog in Derby, Sunbird Records in Darwin, the Polar Bear in Hull, the Glad Cafe in Glasgow, the Bunkhouse in Swansea, the Snug in Atherton, and the Ferret in Preston. The prospectus also introduces a board that will initially oversee the new entity until later this year. That includes Bonita McKinney, who's currently co-chair of the MVT board, agent Phyllis Belezos, artists Rhoda Dakar, plus a number of people who bring finance, legal and property expertise to the table.
Now, the Music Venue Trust have been planning this initiative for quite a long time. Certainly, the concept of trying to get the buildings occupied by grassroots venues owned by an entity that exists to allow those venues to operate has been part of MVT's plan for quite some time. And then behind the scenes, more recently, this specific way of achieving it has been in development. Finally launched properly last week. And around that launch, the CEO of the Music Venues Trust, Mark David, said, "This is the most ambitious initiative Music Venue Trust has ever undertaken. The long-term security and prosperity of grassroots music venues depends almost entirely on one thing, ownership. Too many of these venues have been at the mercy of some commercial landlords whose motivations revolve primarily around profit." He then goes on, "We have lost over a third of our venues in the last 20 years, and of those still operating, over 90% have only 18 months left on their tenancies as we currently speak, which means we are at the cliff edge and could see the decimation of our sector if we don't do something radical about it. The Music Venue Property Scheme will allow ethical investors and music fans to invest in the future of live music while receiving a healthy return on their money." He then noted all of the various initiatives that MVT ran during the pandemic to help venues weather that particular storm. And he added, "Our Save Our Venues campaign, launched during the pandemic, raised over £4.1 million with more than 80,000 people contributing. That means that he is certain that MVT already has the crowd. We just need to ask them to invest. That is what they started doing last week." And Mark David concluded, "We are confident that they will."
Yeah, as we record this podcast, a few days into the campaign, 121 people have committed more than £200,000 to the initiative, with the aim to reach the initial target over the next 4 months. So yeah, if you're interested in getting involved, we will put the link you need in the show notes for this episode. I mean, I think this is a really exciting project.
It really is. And as I say, you know, the Music Venue Trust guys have been talking about this concept for quite some time. And when they first raised it, it was like, okay, interesting concept. How are you going to achieve that? How will it work? So really interesting to see, you know, a really firm plan now in place. So we'll be watching very closely this pilot, both the fundraising period over the summer, and then assuming they raise the funds, them acquiring these buildings and what it means for those venues. And I mean, let's really hope that it will work. It's not to say that these venues, even the venues that end up being in buildings owned by this new entity, they'll still face lots of challenges, the licensing challenges, the noise complaints, rising costs, etc. But those venues who are owned by an entity that exists to allow grassroots venues to operate are going to be in so much of a better position to tackle those other challenges. And as the MVT say, so many of those other issues are impacted by the commercial landlords that ultimately own the buildings. So yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how the fundraising period goes, and fingers crossed that will be a success, and then what happens next. And hopefully, out of this, we won't have to write quite so regularly about venues facing closure because of rent and landlord issues.
Yeah, I mean, for, you know, as long as I've been doing this job, writing about grassroots music venues has been quite depressing, because, I mean, you know, we know how many venues we've lost in the UK over the last, you know, however many, 10, 15 years. And this seems like a positive story, and it seems like a positive thing. And hopefully it is really successful, just to take the pressure off small venues that often are living life on the edge a bit. It would be a really positive thing for both the people running those venues and the people who go to them and the bands who play in them. It seems like a win-win-win. I mean, there's lots of people involved. Win-win-win-win all round.
So anybody listening who has a little bit of money that you'd like to invest, you are ultimately investing in property, as we said, so it's not that risky an investment, but it will give you the warm glow of knowing that you're making a difference. So yeah, do go and follow that link that we'll include in the notes and go and read up on how the program is working, and if you're in a position to put some money in, how you might go about doing that.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, Sony Music announced last Thursday that it is extending its programme to pay through royalties to artists on unrecouped old record deals, so that any artists who signed those deals more than 20 years ago will now benefit, with a new group of artists qualifying each year. It was a commitment welcomed by artist and manager groups, and which puts new pressure on Warner Music and Universal Music to make similar commitments.
And who doesn't love a little bit of pressure being put on Warner Music? And Universal Music on
it's one of my favourite things.
On a Thursday morning. this announcement was made in the middle of the night because it was part of an investor call with Sony Core's investors. And of course, that's in Japan. So this was a middle of the night story. But before we delve actually into this announcement, should we do a bit more background? I don't think this background bit is quite so much stating the bloody obvious. Unless, of course, you're a regular listener to Setlist, in which case you've heard this far too many times. But on the off chance, there is somebody tuning in for the first time. Let me explain what this is all about. And in order to do that, we need to talk a little bit about how record deals work. So when an artist signs a conventional record deal with a conventional record company, any cash advance that they receive in their bank account as the deal is done, and depending on the deal, some of the other upfront costs incurred by the label as well, are recoupable, which means that the label can recoup those costs out of any income generated by the artist's recordings that are subject to the deal, and usually specifically out of the artist's share of that money, which on a conventional record deal would usually be a minority share. That means that the artist will only actually receive new monies in their bank account once all of those costs have been covered and the artist is said to have recouped. But here's the thing. Plenty of artists who have signed record deals of this kind over the years never actually recoup on contract. So they never pay back the advance and all of the other recoupable costs out of their cut of subsequent recordings money. So they never get new royalties in their bank account. And that meant that when streaming took off and the record industry's catalogue suddenly surged in value because the catalogue was available on demand to everybody, and unlike in the iTunes era where if people were accessing catalogue through the iTunes store, they were spending money specifically on the catalogue, whereas obviously in the streaming age, the catalogue is just there, you've already paid your subscription fee, so more people are listening to catalogue than ever before, which means the record industry's catalogue is making more money than ever before. But in some cases, some people might even say many cases, would we go as far as most cases? I don't know if we would. Possibly. But In some cases, we'll definitely go with some. In some cases, the heritage artists who appeared on those recordings that were suddenly surging in value in the streaming age weren't actually seeing the benefit of that, because any monies they were due from the streams of their old recordings were just paying off these unrecouped balances. And as a result, once the whole streaming economy and the streaming business was in the spotlight, this became one of the music industry practices that was increasingly criticised, particularly by artists and songwriters and their managers and lawyers and accountants, many of whom pointed out that just because an artist hasn't recouped doesn't mean that the label hasn't gone into profit on its original investment in the artist. Sometimes it does. But because under a conventional record deal, the label gets the majority of the income and the artist is recouping whatever is recoupable out of their minority share, a label can go into profit on an investment and it can still take years for the artist to actually recoup and see new royalties from the use of their music. And as a result of that, this practice of having artists who decades after a deal are still paying off unrecouped monies and therefore not getting new royalties became something that plenty of artists and songwriters and managers started to criticise.
Now, some indie labels have already dealt with that criticism by adopting the practice of writing off unrecouped balances after a period of time, so artists would start getting royalty payments in their bank accounts. But Sony was the first of the majors to announce that it would start paying royalties through to any unrecouped artist who had signed their deal before the year 2000 and hadn't received any additional advances since then. That announcement came last June as the UK Parliament's Culture Select Committee was finishing off its much-discussed On Setlist inquiry into the economics of streaming. And the move was welcomed by MPs who called on Warner Music and Universal Music to follow suit, which they both did earlier this year. However, those commitments specifically related to artists signed, as I said, before 2000. Artist and manager groups, while welcoming those commitments, also said that the majors should make a long-term rolling commitment so that after a set period of time, other unrecouped artists would automatically qualify to receive royalties, which is what Sony has just done.
Yeah, so last week, Sony Music boss Rob Stringer made this new commitment, as I say, as part of his annual presentation to Sony Core investors in Japan. Well, the investors could be anywhere in the world, couldn't they? But as a Japanese company, the presentation was officially made in Japan to those investors. And in that presentation, Rob Stringer said, "At Sony Music Group, we take pride in our efforts to be the most creator-friendly company in the modern music industry." I mean, it's certainly true that with things like this, Sony currently has the edge. Sony, in terms of the majors, Sony has done a very good job of being the company that says, okay, what is there on the artist gripe list that we can deal with? We'll deal with it. And then that will force Warner and Universal to follow suit. So it's certainly true in terms of the majors that they have become the company that's dealing with some of the common artist gripes and then forcing the other two to follow. And that's a good look to have. Although I think some in the indie space and the BMGs of this world would argue that maybe Sony isn't the most creator-friendly company in the entire music industry. But you can all have your own opinion on that. That's not what we're here to do today. We don't judge, do we?
Never.
We never judge. At Sony Music Group, we take pride in our efforts to be the most creator-friendly company in the modern music industry.
Sorry, carry on.
That's not meant to be funny.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not judging. Try again.
At Sony Music Group, said Rob Stringer, we take pride in our efforts to be the most creator-friendly company in the modern music industry, and we will keep searching for the most principled ways to represent our talent. Serious stuff here. Stop laughing. We became the first major music company, I guess, to pay through earnings to many long-standing artists and songwriters, regardless of any recoupment status, he then added. And now we are expanding that effort to include even more qualifying artists who have been signed to us for more than 20 years by offering eligibility for this scheme on a rolling basis. So the notes that accompanied this then clarified that what this means is that this commitment to pay through royalties to artists who signed their deals decades ago, but who have not recouped on the original advance, etc. Now, if their deal is pre-2001 rather than pre-2000, they will now be eligible to get royalties, and actually they'll be getting royalties from streams this year, and that will all start to kick in later in the year. And then the key point is that this is an ongoing commitment. So every year, presumably on the 1st of January, a load of artists who signed their deals 20 years ago, providing they've not had lots of extra cash advances from Sony in the meantime, will suddenly qualify and will suddenly start getting new royalties.
Now, Sony says that thousands of artists and songwriters have already benefited from its previous commitment on unrecouped balances, together receiving millions of dollars in new royalties, and thousands more will benefit from this new commitment. And the UK's Music Managers Forum and Featured Artists Coalition both welcomed that new commitment, with their CEOs Annabella Koldrick and David Martin saying, "We welcome the news that Sony Music Entertainment are to disregard unrecouped balances on artists' accounts on a rolling annual basis. The policy echoes measures that the FAC and the MMF have long been calling for. It means that every 12 months a new cohort of artists can benefit from the growth in music consumption and finally earn an income from their work. Sony's approach, writing off debt in this way, is the right one, marking a further step towards fairer and more collaborative relationships between labels and artists."
And of course, all of this is coming as, here in the UK, the government-initiated working groups and committees looking at the economics of streaming are continuing to discuss and debate various policies and measures that could deal with some of the issues that were raised about the way streaming works, about the way the music industry works, during that parliamentary inquiry, the economics of streaming inquiry. And an assortment of proposals are being considered by those committees, some around transparency, some around data. Of course, there are still those who argue that there should be some sort of minimum rate for artists, particularly heritage artists, when it comes to what royalties they are paid when their music is streamed, particularly those heritage artists who have deals that only talk about CDs or even vinyl and cassette, and maybe the royalty rate that was agreed in the 80s or the 90s around a CD is being applied to streams. And obviously we've talked endlessly on the podcast how plenty of people say that doesn't seem right, and maybe, well, whenever we talk about things like this, we tend to focus on what the Beggars Group do because they are pioneers in this space and very transparent about what they do. And so, for example, we mentioned that some indies had done this, writing off unrecouped balances after a period of time quite some time ago. So Beggars actually writes off unrecouped balances after 15 years. But another thing that the Beggars Group does is it has a minimum royalty rate for streams that it applies across the catalogue, oblivious of what a 1990s or a 1980s deal might say. And that's another thing which plenty of people in the artist and management community would like to see embraced more widely across the record industry. But nevertheless, as I say, this is Sony sort of taking the lead again in saying, okay, there are all these things being touted around, but this is something that we are embracing, paying through royalties to artists who haven't recouped on these old deals. We were the first major to make that commitment, and now we're the first major to confirm that that's going to be a rolling commitment. And I mean, I would anticipate that Warner Music and Universal Music will presumably make similar commitments at some point. I mean, it took them, what, 8 or 9 months after Sony's initial announcement to confirm they were going to follow Sony's lead. So I guess we will wait to see whether or not we do get confirmation from Warner and Universal that they are also going to make this a rolling commitment.
Oh, right. Well, I was going to say, you promised at the beginning that this was going to be a 40-minute podcast, and we're quite under, so I was going to suggest we just wait and see. But I guess those commitments aren't going to come through that quickly.
Yeah, I guess this podcast, as you say, we're actually being quite punchy this week. I have to say, I think that's because we didn't waffle quite so much in the introduction.
It didn't help that we lost the podcast once as well.
We did. The half of this podcast was recorded twice. But
see if you can guess which half.
While that's a nice idea, that we pad out this slightly short edition of Setlist waiting for Warner and Universal's announcements, I mean, we only need 10 minutes, don't we, to pad this out. And my feeling is that in the next 10 minutes, we're recording this on Friday morning, I don't think in the next 10 minutes we're going to get an announcement from Warner or Universal on this. So let's not do that.
I've got a great new podcast idea, though.
What? To
Man refreshes email. I've clicked nothing. Nothing. Oh, hang on. Let me look in this folder. No.
Yeah.
I'll look in a different account.
I think 10 minutes of this could prove to be quite tedious.
And 40 minutes. This is the pilot. Next week, it's going to be 40 minutes of this. Nothing.
I'm going to propose...
Hang on.
...that we don't sit here...
Nothing.
...and wait for Universal and Warner's announcement, partly because I'm not buying this concept, even as a section at the end of a podcast, let alone
I know, I've never heard this podcast before.
More importantly than that...
It's not often you get a new idea in podcasting.
I'm meeting someone for lunch.
New emails just come in.
I've got to go.
No, it's not that.
Someone's buying me a steak dinner, and you know... ...that while I am very dedicated and committed to this podcast... I'm also very committed to people buying me steak dinners. Everyone listening, you'd like to buy me a steak dinner for lunch, you can book in. Setlist, unlimitedmedia.co.
No, that's not what that email address is for.
But I am going to make the bold decision that even if we were to do 40 minutes of you clicking refresh, we would not, at the end of this podcast, have an announcement from Universal and Warner. And if that means that when this podcast goes out on Monday morning, we're out of date, because they did actually issue a statement to that effect, I'm willing to be attached officially on my birthday to a out-of-date podcast.
It wouldn't be the first time.
Will you second my motion that we should wrap this up?
Yeah, all right then. Let's just do, say that that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed this week, you will find links in the show notes, which are in your podcast player now, or at setlistpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show so that you receive new episodes automatically every single week. What are we doing next week? There's like two bank holidays. Are we going to record on Wednesday?
It depends what you're
Let's
planning
do
on doing.
Admin on the...
Are you planning on celebrating the Platinum Jubilee?
Well, no, but I'd still take the 2 days off. I'm not planning to come into work.
You will be playing that new track from The Cunts on repeat to try and get it to number two in the charts. Is that what you're going to be doing?
Could be.
For the Jubilee? Did you see that they've put together... We alluded to this on last... I say we alluded to it. We outright stated on last week's set list that there are two tracks that have come out today as we record this, which are both aiming to be in the charts on Friday, which is in the middle of the Queen of the United Kingdom's Platinum Jubilee celebrations. So you've got a new version of God Save the Queen, the national anthem, and then you've got a track by The Cunts called, what's it called?
Prince Andrew is a Sweaty Nonce.
And on Spotify, they've put together a playlist that they're encouraging people to listen to because there are a number of remixes of the track. I think that's on the basis that the remix still count in the charts. So if
yes,
people are listening...
There are 10 versions. If you buy all 10, it counts as 10 sales.
Because they're 10 different versions. But I think I'm right in saying on Spotify, they've put all of those into a playlist that's something like 5,000 tracks long. So you could spend the entire 4 days of the Platinum Jubilee weekend listening to that, although only one day of that would help with the chart battle, wouldn't it? But
currently God Save the Queen, the new version, is not actually available on Spotify. It's greyed out.
Oh.
So that means that The Cunts are the top of our new music playlist at the moment. So
well,
anyway, we seem to have deviated again. I'll just check my email again because we've been talking a little while. Nothing. Nothing at all. Where did I get to? This is...
Goodbye. Did you say goodbye?
I said goodbye. I got halfway through saying all the stuff. Subscribe, rate, review, email us. Don't email us about steak because I check that email. I don't eat meat, so I don't want to hear about steak. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.